The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Today we're going to talk about evolution, the earliest nervous systems. The evolution, we know why were nervous systems so important with multicellular organisms? Single cell organisms can do a lot and they don't have nervous systems. But remember, they have the primitive cellular mechanisms, they respond to inputs, the effects of inputs are conducted throughout the cell, they respond to cells. They do a lot of things that multicellular organisms do. But as soon as you start putting a lot of cells together, then you have the problem of integration, one part of the organism with another. Okay, so what are some multipurpose actions that every animal, even one cell organisms, must be able to perform? I teach animal behavior, and so this, to me, even though it's omitted by a lot of behavioral textbooks and teachers, to me, you've got to start with the fundamentals. What do all animals do? Locomotion. Big one. You know, what do they use locomotion for? To escape from things, to get away from things, and to grab things. Either attack them and kill them and eat them, or find food in some other way. It requires locomotion. Unless, there are a few exceptions, there are animals that have evolved, at least at certain stages of their life, sessile forms where they just sit. But most organisms have to locomote. Towards or away from things. What else? What is another multi-purpose action? Reproduction, very basic. But reproduction, that's a broader thing. I'm talking about fundamental action patterns. So let's go back from reproduction. But these things we're talking about are involved in reproduction. You're absolutely right. And that's particularly fundamental because that's what drives evolution. Responding to a stimulus, very basic, but I want the action. How do they respond to the stimulus besides locomoting? Yes? Orienting, turning. Animals have to respond to where things are. Okay? So, locomotion, approaching, orienting towards or away again. And then I've added here exploring or foraging or seeking. But you see, that's just includes the first two. But what is included in foraging that's not necessarily in those first two? Locomotion and orient. There's an element that's involved. I think I probably asked that. Yeah, here. That's the next question. Okay? Approach and avoidance or flight movements are controlled by sensory inputs, plus one other important thing. What is that other thing? Very important in the evolution of the CNS. Grasping is part of, will include, yeah, grasping is actually a third fundamental action. But grasping isn't always. I'm thinking of something else. Anybody? Yes? Motivation. The internal drive. Something that comes from inside. I mean, why are they locomoting in one direction now, another direction another time? Why are they trying to get to food one time, to a mate another time, and so on and so forth? Depends on internal states. Alright. And then, as I mentioned, in that earlier slide, we didn't get through everything there, but I asked a question about it here. What are the ongoing maintenance activities or background activities that are happening all the time? While the locomotion is happening, while the orienting is happening, you know, whatever the motivation, it's independent of motivation, what are the ongoing background activities and what kind of nervous system mechanism is involved? Yes? Yeah, things that are maintained, need to be maintained in a constant state. That's good. Can anybody think of other things? Think of when you're doing one of these fundamental things. You're locomoting. You're going to your next class. What are the background things going on? What is your body doing? What's it maintaining in homeostasis? Your temperature, for example. Even protists will seek places of the right temperature. They may not have much internal. They're not endothermic, okay, but like we are, but they still have some kind of regulation. They still have to eliminate, they still have to, you know. What about a quadruped now, like, or a two- or four-legged animal? What does he do when he's locomoting? What is the maintenance? Balance. Yeah, posture. This happened. What are the mechanisms now that control these background things? What do we call them? They're lower-level mechanisms for the most part. Many of them are spinal mechanisms, as we'll be talking about. Yes? A lot of them are reflexes. Very simple local pathways. That's exactly right. Okay? Simple reflexes and simple programs that are ongoing so they don't... Heart rates is one. The heart, of course, has its own ganglion that's regulating it, but it's influenced by the central nervous system also. It's adjusted because you need a lot more blood flow when you're running than you do when you're not running, and things like that. All right. So now let's start talking about conduction. Get to nerve cells. How can conduction between cells occur without synaptic connections? We find such conduction before we find wheel neurons. It's found in sponges even, as well as in the cnidarians like Hydra. Most of these things I'm going to talk about are found in little creatures like Hydra. We used to call them the chelenterates. That's been revised. Now the cnidarians. Even sponges have conduction between cells. If you touch a sponge, it's just not the cells that you're touching that are responding. Other cells respond too. Yeah, there is a kind of electrical conduction. This people sometimes call this conduction myoid and neuroid, just meaning it's like conduction between muscle cells, it's like conduction between nerve cells, but it's not really the same as in advanced organisms. It's a term used in Nauta and Firetalk's book, and it's used in by others that talk about primitive conductive mechanisms. And it's been in the study of the anatomy of those creatures that we get ideas about earliest stages of nervous system evolution. I've taken these pictures that I put in the book, George Parker at Yale, who was the guy who first tried to do it, but George Mackey, who updated it, wrote a nice paper in the Quarterly Review of Biology in 1970. This is his earliest stage. There you have contractile cells that are also sensory. So they're sensory and motor. They're responding to the environment. They can contract. But he shows this he indicates this dashed line where the membranes are against each other. That simply means gap junctions, something equivalent to gap junctions in our own nervous systems. It's electrical conduction where charged ions can flow from one cell to the other. So an electrical change that starts here can spread down the line. Okay? And here's the second stage where there are some contractile cells now that are no longer directly responsive to the environment. He calls them protomyocytes. They separate from the epithelium. They're below the epithelium, but you can see they're still joined to these epithelial cells by these gap junction type contacts that allow the electrical changes in one cell to influence the cell that it's next to. It's not like axonal conduction. The effect doesn't always spread to the entire organism. It often diminishes the further you get from the source. And here, the contractile cells are no longer directly connected to most of these cells. There are neurons in the epithelium that are like neurons in that they have an axon, a process, an axon-like process that extends down to the muscle cells. The connections are still all electrical in nature. There's no chemical secretion yet triggering a response in the next cell. He calls them protoneurons. You know, they are epithelial cells. We have some primary sensory neurons that are just like this. We'll talk about that in a minute. And there is an electrical contact with the contractile cell, which are now, you know, completely subepithelial. No, their only contact with the epithelium is through these axon-like processes. And then he has real neurons appearing, motor neurons, with a chemical synapse. When he looked at Hydra, he found things like this, evidence for chemical synapses contacting the contractile cells. And it was those cells then that got input from the epithelial. Now you can call it a primary sensory neuron. So now you've got a two synapse nervous system. What was missing? Nauta studied the earlier, he knew Mackey's work, he knew the George Parker work. He cites mainly Parker. But he realized there's something missing. There's no intermediate network. And that's what I added as a question here, the addition emphasized by Nauta. I'm sorry I answered it for you. This is the picture then that Nauta added. So in Nauta's book, he has those earlier stages, and then he has cells in between the sensory neuron. He has the axon now not directly contacting either a muscle cell or a motor neuron, but contacting a neuron in between. So this is a neuron now that's not in direct contact with the environment outside, and it's not contacting contractile cells. It is really an intermediate neuron. So we would define this as a motor neuron, and of course the muscle cell. This is what we could call primary sensory, but then these are the intermediate. And that's the beginning of what Nauta refers to as the great intermediate network. So now let's define for every nervous system, including mammalian, primary sensory neuron, secondary sensory neuron, motor neuron, and intermediate network neuron. Just summarize that. I've done it in a diagram. But can you define them now? Remember, I want you to read before you come to class, and you should already be able to do this. There's one person, two people that have not said anything yet. So speak up. Define just one of these. What's a motor neuron? Or yeah, define any of them. Okay, the primary sensory neuron. And what is it contacting? Where does its axon go? To a secondary sensory neuron, and where is that one? Is it also in the periphery? No. The secondary sensory neuron is in the CNS. The primary sensory neuron is not. Major difference between those two types. Otherwise, what you said is completely right. Okay, now what about the motor neuron? I've defined it maybe 3 times so far in the class. In the corner, what is the motor neuron?
I'm actually not sure.
Okay. Okay, well, if you don't want to answer it, somebody else. But if you come to the class, I do expect you to be able to answer some questions, okay? So, somebody else. You want to go on? So, define it again, the motor neuron. Where is the cell body of the motor neuron? In the central nervous system. And the axon goes out and contact the muscle cell. Exactly. So that's how I came up with this diagram. There's one other cell type in here, though. It's not primary sensory neuron. It's not secondary sensory neuron. It's not a motor neuron. Exactly. There's two others. There's cells like this, and even the secondary sensory neuron is sometimes included in that intermediate network. Okay? But since we define secondary sensory already, we'll include all the rest that are not motor neurons as intermediate network neurons. And I should point out, this is a good way to do it right now, that many neuroanatomists, when they talk about an interneuron, they always mean a short axon interneuron, like these. Of course, I've greatly simplified, not showing the dendrites, simplifying the axon. But still, basically, that's the way a short axon interneuron connects. But broadly speaking, these are all interneurons if they're not primary sensory and they're not motor. Everything else is an interneuron. We define secondary sensory separately. Most neuroanatomists would talk about the long axon cells in the central nervous system. They usually don't bother to call them interneurons, but they actually are. They just have much stronger axons. Okay, now we've got another cell type here. It's not in the central nervous system. It's in contact with a motor neuron. At least it's a neuron that looks like a motor neuron because its axon is leaving the central nervous system. What is it? It's in a peripheral ganglion. It's a preganglionic motor neuron here, and a ganglionic motor neuron here. And the ganglionic motor neurons contact the smooth muscle, or gland cells, causing glandular secretions, causing contraction of the gut, or of some other organ. No, they are not. We call these interneurons here, of course, it's a type of interneuron, but it's defined as a motor neuron in contact with the central nervous system through a preganglionic motor neuron. We call this a motor neuron because it's got an axon that causes some kind of movement or contraction or secretion. Secretion is considered an output, okay? So it's an output neuron, but it exerts its action through a peripheral ganglion. So a sympathetic ganglion or a parasympathetic ganglion cell, which we will be defining in more detail soon. Okay. So what, just remember for me now the answer to question 5. Where are neuronal cell bodies of the peripheral nervous system located? If you have cell bodies and they're in the periphery, we say they are in a ganglion. Okay? What about these words? What is a nerve and what is a tract? And there's some other names we could add to that. But just figure out, just take those two. Nerve and tract. Define nerve for me. Anybody want to try? That's very good, except it's not always true. Many nerves don't have a common origin. They can be mixed. They can come from various sources. In fact, they might not even end up at the same place. That's not what defines a nerve. First of all, where is a nerve? In the periphery. We don't, if you hear people talking about nerves in the brain or spinal cord, you'll know that they're not neuroanatomists and they've never had this class. Okay? Because we don't call them nerves unless they're in the periphery. Okay? In the central nervous system, we call them a tract, or we give them some other name. We call them a bundle, a tract, a fasciculus, a lemniscus, all very descriptive terms of what these are like. Bundle, that's clear. Okay. Lemniscus means ribbon. So they're a ribbon of fibers. Fasciculus, basically a term meaning a group or bundle of axons. Okay. So they all mean bundles of axons, but you've got to keep separate the terms we use for central nervous system and peripheral nervous system. So on this slide, I've just put a bunch of these things. They're all defined in Chapter 3. There's a few things we haven't mentioned, like the different cell groups. We call them ganglia outside the central nervous system. But in the central nervous system, yes, we violate our rules sometimes when we talk about the basal ganglia. That has to do with the history of the field. But usually, in the central nervous system, groups of cells that are functionally distinct and or anatomically distinct, or usually both, we call them nuclei, just to confuse you more, because it doesn't mean nucleus of a cell at all. It's a grouping of cells. And we give them various specific names. Okay. We'll get to notochord and neural tube very soon. What's the animal that is called in my book the simplest living chordate? There are others in the group, the cephalochordates, that have a similar structure, but there's this particular one. Sorry, what did I do? Yeah, the... What's the animal that's pointed at both ends? Amphioxus. Okay, and that little Amphioxus can be found even in waters around here. It's very common. I may have said in the book that it was mostly southern waters, but we do now find them fairly far north as well. It has another name that's more common among scientific systematic people who do systems biology. Well, chordate is the phylum. They are called the simplest living chordate. The branchiostoma is the other name. So when you look things up on Amphioxus, you want to try searching both. But because Amphioxus is so popular, because it's so descriptive, meaning sharp at both ends, it's still both used, so I use both. You can see it is sort of sharp at both ends. This is a picture of its nervous system. Notice, it's not much bigger there than it is anywhere. Okay? It is a chordate. So what is a chordate? What defines a chordate? We are a chordate. This is a basically simplified a reconstruction done of Amphioxus. It has along the back a nerve cord. That is its central nervous system. You can see it runs almost the entire length. I've indicated just to emphasize there, very slight, something different way at the front end. Yes, it does have a brain. It's a little hard to make out. You don't study it with the microscope. But what is that? It has no skeleton except that. It's another cord. It's not a nerve cord. Okay? It's cartilage. Okay? It's called the notochord. And all chordates, at some stage in their development, usually at least early in development, have a notochord along the dorsal side. Okay? That's the notochord. And the dorsal nerve cord, or central nervous system, develops in all chordates, you know, just above or just dorsal to that notochord. Notice it's got an odd spelling. It's looks like music, notochord, but that is the way it's spelled. Okay? So what does that central nervous system, that nerve cord, look like? This is another picture I simplified from a recent study. And I've shown in blue there the central nervous system. It's basically a tube with somewhat thickened walls. Okay, so it's the neural tube with a ventricle in the middle. Can't really see there very well. But you do see peripheral nerves that are extending into that nerve cord. You also see outputs from mostly on the ventral side here. And note that they're unlike all the vertebrates. And we didn't know this in the early studies. Nauta didn't know it, actually, because the electron microscopic reconstructions hadn't been done. These are muscle cells. These are groups of muscles. And these are muscle processes that extend right up to the nerve cord. And they poke right into the nerve cord. And they directly contact the motor neurons in the ventral part of that nerve. That's a peculiarity of Amphioxus. Okay, what's the Bell-Majendie law? There's something in what I was just saying was almost getting to that. The Bell-Majendie law, what is it? What do we usually call it more popularly and less historically? Discovered by Charles Bell. Francois Majendie, Bell 1811, Majendie 1823. Even though it was a discovery about mammals, about the nerves that come in and attach to the central nervous system, the spinal cord. They always divide and to a dorsal root and a ventral root as they approach the cord. The dorsal root contains, actually, the dorsal root ganglion cells. So we'll see pictures of that in a minute. Sensory fibers, the inputs come in dorsally. The outputs, those axons of the motor neurons, remember in the picture of Cajal I showed you, the axons were going out ventrally. Okay? That's the ventral root, it's motor. But then I ask you here, so that's the law of roots, the Bell-Majin-D law. Is it always true? It's mostly true here. I mean, yeah, they're not actual axons going out, but the motor outputs are going out ventrally. The sensory inputs are coming in dorsally. But one thing really odd about amphioxus is at one level of the nervous system, the nerves come in on one side and they go out the other side. You go to the next nerve, it does have multiple nerves. You see here are the different roots. The next segment down, you would find the input, the nerve from the periphery coming in dorsally, and the muscles being driven from the ventral part of the cord. So it alternates. Not only that, there are a few motor axons in that dorsal root. There are violations, and if you study other creatures in great detail, you will find, even in higher vertebrates, you will find a few exceptions to the law of roots. But for the most part, and when, you know, in neuroanatomy, it's not quite like physics. In case you're from physics or engineering, you know, there are a lot of exceptions. And that's a lot of times what we're describing is, by and large, true. Okay. So think of the Bell-Majin-D that law that way. It's usually true. What is meant by primary brain vesicles? I indicated something odd here about the very front end. That's his brain. The amphioxus does have the beginning of primary brain vesicles. What are they? We defined it before. I don't expect you necessarily to remember it, but now you've read about it again, because in chapter 3, what are the three primary brain vesicles? Now I've added, I've told you there's three of them. Hindbrain, midbrain, and forebrain. Okay, those are the primary brain vesicles. They generally are vesicles in that they swell a little bit. They're a little bit bigger than the spinal cord below. And they usually get a little smaller at their boundary. So you can see a distinct, and during development of human and just about every other vertebrate, you do see three, at least early in development. Now, number 10 there asks for a little more detail. But this is another question that the answer would be the same for amphioxus and for mammals. In what subdivision of the CNS do visual inputs enter? Describe or name the two visual inputs found in many chordates. The diencephalon, yeah, the tween brain. Which of the brain vesicles is diencephalon in? Part of the forebrain. Okay, it's the caudal part of the forebrain. It's not part of the cerebral hemispheres. They balloon out from the diencephalon. Okay. So here's amphioxus. This is from Allman. And he shows the arrangement of cells near their, a little pigmented area, you see, right at the front end of the animal. And These are pigmented cells. Next to them are receptor cells responding to light. Next to them are neurons that have axons that travel to other parts of the nervous system. The arrangement, that very simple arrangement in amphioxus is very much like the developing retina in vertebrates. Here's the pigment epithelium. Here are the receptor cells. Here are the neurons. The receptor cells, sometimes they're really primary sensory neurons, very specialized for responding to light energy. And then the neurons in the retina, besides the interneurons, the main ones are the bipolar cells and the retinal ganglion cells. And it's the ganglion cells that give rise to these long axons, just like these cells in amphioxus. Okay. Now, these are cartoons of amphioxus on top and a primitive vertebrate on the bottom. It was based originally just on structural studies, but gene expression studies have shown now and confirmed that amphioxus has a region that expresses the genes of the spinal cord. He has a small region that expresses the genes of the midbrain, the segments of the midbrain, mainly one segment in vertebrates. And then, more rostrally, the rest of it is like the tween brain, but he doesn't have the end brain, or an olfactory bulb. Okay? The olfactory bulb is part of the end brain of vertebrates. And notice here, there you see the retina, so ballooning out, another kind of outpouching, like the hemispheres, but now it still remains part of the diencephalon. That's the retina. Okay. So there you have that visual area of amphioxus. Here you have it in a vertebrate. And here is the other area. Remember I said there were two. Well, at the opposite side of the tween brain, we have what we call an epithalamus. It's another, the most caudal segment of the developing tween brain. Okay. That's where many chordates have a pineal eye, an eye on top of the head that responds to light. And it's involved in control of photoperiodic behavior. And even in us, that region controls the daily cycle of secretion of melatonin, even though it doesn't directly respond to light anymore. You know, the animals we use in the lab, like the mouse, the mouse has got a pretty thin skull, and he's got cells there that actually do directly respond to light that gets through the skull. But the main inputs come through the lateral eyes, these eyes, through an indirect pathway. Okay. You should be able to summarize the basic rules of evolution. I do it on the next slide here. You should know the basic processes that govern evolution. And it's all right if you assume that natural selection, just like Darwin believed, is the major factor that causes gene sorting, survival of some genes and not of others, or decrease in the frequency of some genes, increase in the frequency of others. Okay, so I just summarize that and I write it out in a pretty straightforward way in the book. In the animal behavior class, I do talk a little bit about other mechanisms of genetic change that can result in changes outside of natural selection that still are important in evolution. There's various argument about just how important those things are. So when you think now about that very simple neural tube, the beginning of the central nervous system, you've got to say, well, how did that little worm-like animal or animals like that, how did that end up evolving primates? You've got to think about the highest priorities in evolution, and I've consistently done that through the book. And I've taken this, a nice phrase from Ken Elliott, who wrote this book in 69, who has this phrase near the beginning of the book. Every brain system grows logically from the tooth. What he simply meant was that by small steps, by processes of natural selection, that neural tube developed the way we have it into current species. So, it's mostly speculation, and these are the questions I was following, just looking across the existing animals, and also using some paleontology. So that's what we're going to do next time. We're going to talk about the ancestors of mammals. We'll sketch a simple pre-mammalian brain. Well, how could I guess what a pre-mammalian brain is like? It's actually based mostly on an amphibian brain. Okay, but we do have skulls of the group of animals that led to the evolution of mammals. They were running around the forest floor at the time of the big dinosaurs. They evolved with the dinosaurs. They were the cynodonts. Okay? We'll talk about that other stuff next time. These are the cynodonts. Okay? This is just a few of them. Reconstructed, we don't really know their colors. We just have the skulls. But we do know a little about their brain because the skull, the inside of the skull preserves the shape of the central nervous system. Just like we find the vertebrae and we know how big the spinal cord was. We know in Brontosaurus, his lumbar enlargement was probably bigger than his brain. But he was a very, very large animal and needed a lot of neurons there to control those enormous rear legs. But okay, so we'll be talking about a brain that we'll assume is, if you don't like thinking in terms of evolution, you can think of it as an amphibian. But we think it's something like the early cynodonts, because the early cynodonts, by the time you have the late cynodonts, they're pretty similar to mammals. Okay. So that's what we'll be doing next time. And that's all the time we have.